Hello and a warm welcome to Radio Prague. My name is Ian Willoughby. We begin the program with the news. Prime Minister Stanislav Gross has refused to react to a threat by the Christian Democrats to push for early elections and leave the governing coalition if Mr. Gross is not replaced at a Social Democrats Party conference next weekend. Christian Democrat Chairman Miroslav Kalousek has been calling for Mr. Gross's resignation since the Prime Minister and his wife became involved in a financial scandal. Meanwhile, a Prague advertising agency is offering Czechs the chance to appear on billboards critical of the Prime Minister at a special cut-price rate, the newspaper Nedělní Svět reported on Sunday. For 3,000 Czech crowns, or around $130, people can have their own photo on the billboards, beside the slogan, "I'm ashamed of my Prime Minister." The billboards are something of a parody of Social Democrat pre-election adverts from last year featuring Mr. Gross. President Václav Klaus has said the Czech Republic does not have a shortage of judges, adding that the country had the highest number per citizen of any OECD country. Mr. Klaus's remarks follow controversy over his refusal to appoint a number of judges because they were under the age of 30. Speaking on Czech radio on Saturday, the president said the real problem was the placement of judges in different parts of the country and the way the courts were organized. Around 200 people have held a demonstration in Prague on the second anniversary of the beginning of the United States-led war against Iraq. The demonstrators compared the U.S. presence in Iraq to the Soviet invasion of Czechoslovakia in 1968 and called on President George Bush to withdraw U.S. troops from the country. The rock group Tata Boys were named Band of the Year at the Czech music industry's annual Anděl or Angel Awards ceremony on Saturday night. Male Singer of the Year was Dan Barta, while the Female Singer of the Year award went to Aneta Langerová, the winner of a television talent contest. The late Zuzana Nazarová was inducted into the Czech Music Hall of Fame at the ceremony in Ostrava. Giant forward Jan Koller is likely to miss the first of two upcoming World Cup qualifying matches against Finland and Andorra. Koller, the second-highest goalscorer in the history of Czech international football, sustained a muscle injury during an appearance for his club Borussia Dortmund. And the weather? The next few days should see continued sunny spells around the country, with temperatures rising to around 18 degrees Celsius in the middle of the week. That's the end of the news.
You're listening to Radio Prague, the international service of Czech radio, and I'm Kate Barrett. Coming up in today's program, the Czech government crisis nears its end with early elections looking likely. We find out more about the current state of Czech-German relations, so don't go away. The drawn-out Czech government crisis is fast approaching a climax. The Christian Democrats, one of the smaller parties in the coalition government, have given the strongest party, the Social Democrats, an ultimatum. Either the Prime Minister, Stanislav Gross, resigns over his and his wife's questionable financial dealings, or the Christian Democrats will trigger the collapse of the government. Daniela Lazarova has been following the story. Daniela, we've been discussing the possible fall of the government for weeks now. Is this really the end of the road?
Well, Kate, that's never an easy question to answer in Czech politics, but it seems that next weekend the Social Democrats Party conference should set the wheels in motion one way or another, and some decision will have to be reached. Interestingly, while at the start of the crisis, most Czech commentators predicted that it would now they're all inclined to believe that all the roads lead to early elections and that they are all long and winding.
So what are the alternatives at this point?
Well, there's the unlikely alternative of the Prime Minister resigning of his own accord, or resigning if he failed to get enough support from his own party, in which case the government would fall, and then the President would have to initiate negotiations on a new government. If such an attempt failed three times in a row, that would open the way to early elections. The second alternative is that the Social Democrats will continue to back the Prime Minister, as they have done, and the Christian Democrats will either propose a deal on early elections or walk out of the coalition government. Now, they've said that if they can make a deal on early elections with their coalition partners, their ministers could remain in cabinet for the duration, which is advantageous for them, of course. And in the past 24 hours, the ruling Social Democrats have for the first time openly admitted that early elections are a possibility. It would shorten their election term somewhat, but only by about 8 months, because early elections would take place in the autumn at the earliest. A third alternative would entail a minority Social Democrat government with support from the Communist Party, but that is really difficult to envisage. The Social Democrats would completely lose face, and it would be too high a price to pay for a few months in office. So I think a deal on early elections seems the most likely alternative. Of course, now the ball is in the Social Democrats' court, and it will be up to them to decide at their party conference next weekend which of those roads they want to go down.
And what about the public? How do they feel about what's happening?
Well, the public generally is extremely wary of it all. I've heard people discussing this out in the street, on trams, in offices, and the most frequent reaction is disgust with the whole situation and anger that the government is not devoting its time to matters of public interest, such as the health and pension reforms. Support for the Prime Minister has plummeted from its original 80% to a mere 18%, and there are now billboards all over Prague reading, "I'm ashamed of my Prime Minister." There's even an internet page on which Czechs express their views about the Prime Minister, and it's definitely not something that he would enjoy reading. So I think that more than anything, Czechs just want the situation resolved one way or another so that they can have a government again that's ready to do some work.
Thanks, Daniela, for summing that up for us. Today, Germany is the Czech Republic's biggest trade partner. German tourists are traditionally among the keenest visitors to this country. But relations between the two countries, whose history is so interconnected, have always been complex. The atrocities of the German occupation during the Second World War and the consequent expulsion of the ethnic German minority from Czechoslovakia still leave a degree of bitterness in the two nations' relations. In order to help create better understanding, a Czech-German conference takes place every year in the Czech town of Jihlava. This year's conference has just ended, and Radio Prague's Martin Mikulaj was there.
Czech and German intellectuals, politicians, but also many people whose personal destiny was somehow influenced by relations between these two nations in the past, have been meeting in Jihlava for the last 14 years. The main topic of this year's conference was the collective memory and its consequences. A group of German activists has recently put forward a proposal for a so-called Zentrum gegen Vertreibung, Center Against Expulsion, that is intended to remind us of the destinies of expelled ethnic groups and prevent such events from happening in the future, says Herbert Werner, the economic director of the German-Czech Future Fund.
I think it ought to be based in Berlin, because from Berlin almost everything of the tragedy of the Hitler regime came from. So it will be the center where the future generations go to, or where they try to find orientation. It should be a center of research, on the deportation of the Germans, but as well on deportations and displacing of persons all over in Europe. Think of the Armenians, think of the deportations Germans did. Germans deported people as well, Stalin deported people as well, and so on.
But many Czechs are against the foundation of such a center, since they are afraid that it could be abused by a group of people, specifically German nationalists, to promote their own version of history. Czech Parliament Chairman Lubomír Zaorálek.
Deutsche Vertreibung or German expulsion can't not be the central trauma of 20th century. It seems to me that what is the main point, what is the pillar and center of this? There are wars in 20th century, for example. I can imagine that it could be many projects which will try in the whole Europe to study and investigate these events. But it seems to me that it's a mistake and failure to start with expulsion as one thing which is cut off this and made as pillar of this event. There's no reason in Czech Republic to support something like this.
Alfred Grosser, a political scientist from the Parisian Institute of Political Studies, has been researching the issue of collective memory. He says that the problems in the relations of the two nations are caused by their unwillingness to sympathize with the suffering of the other side.
A main principle of European unity has not been really understood of either side. It is to have a real understanding for the suffering of the other side. And I think that the Sudetendeutschen do not really understand what Czechoslovakia has suffered from Hitler and from Henlein, by the way. And on the other side, on the Czech side, the tremendous suffering of the expelled Germans have not been accepted. That is for me the root of the whole misunderstanding.
There were many interesting contributions to the conference, some of which could lead to specific projects in the future, but the problem is that in the end the conference is little more than a talking shop. It is not widely discussed in the press or in the public arena, so the possibility for ideas to develop is very limited.
Thanks, Martin. Over the weekend, Czechs were focused on Stars and Angels, that's Pop Stars and Angel Awards. The country's 14th annual Pop Music Awards were held in the Czech city of Ostrava on Saturday night. The evening brought several surprises, with underdogs, the Tata Boys, outshining the band Divoký Byl, who was strongly favored to win. The Tata Boys were one of the most successful groups of the entire evening. They were nominated for 5 awards and took away 3 angels, including Group of the Year, Video of the Year, and Best Sound Recording. They themselves were slightly unprepared for so much success, having just flown in from Japan. They described themselves as outsiders and didn't imagine the night would unfold as it did. Another big winner on Saturday was Anata Langarova, who took Angels for the Best Newcomer and Best Singer, as well as 2 other awards in parallel music competitions. Langarova is hugely popular in the Czech Republic. She became a star last year when she won the country's Pop Idol contest. She's loved and respected for her music, but also for her independent spirit. She categorically refuses the lure of lucrative TV contracts in order to pursue her music her own way. After Saturday's win, she says she doesn't need any more awards, but that she needs time to develop her music and to grow. You're listening to Radio Prague. It's time now for a look at the latest sports news coming out of the Czech Republic, this week with David Vaughan.
Well, thanks, Kate. And starting with ice hockey, the playoffs in the Czech Republic's top competition, the Extraliga, have reached their dramatic closing stage. It's been something of a vintage season this year, in no short measure thanks to the cancellation of the North American NHL season, which has brought many of the Czech stars back to their home clubs. As we reported last week, the first team to be knocked out of the playoffs was Sparta Prague, something of a shock result, in their series against unfancied Vítkovice. The Sparta coach, Slavomír Lenner, promptly resigned after an otherwise good season fell apart. Prague rival Slavia managed to avoid Sparta's 4-1 series debacle, but they didn't fare much better. In Thursday's deciding quarter-final game against playoff newcomers Liberec, they suffered a humiliating 5-1 defeat after going down 3-0 in the first period. Liberec, with their legendary national team goalie 30-year-old Milan Hnilička, will now fight it out in the semis against Pardubice for a slot in the final. This is the first season for years that hasn't seen a Prague side in the top 4. Thursday's other deciding quarter-final duel between Kladno and Pardubice was an altogether much more exciting affair. Kladno, which only two seasons ago came back from relegation, are now in fine form, having benefited hugely from the NHL lockout. And it's been great to see Kladno gold medal veterans from the 98 Nagano Olympics, like Pavel Patera and Martin Prochaska, in action. But in a thrilling game, Kladno were defeated 3-1 by a resilient Pardubice and lost the quarter-final series 4-3. So the four semi-finalists are Pardubice, who will now battle it out with Liberec, and reigning champions Zlín, who faced their tough fellow Moravian rivals Vítkovice on Sunday night in their first encounter of the semi-final series. The two teams couldn't have been better matched, and when Vítkovice equalised in the last minute of the third period, the game was forced into extra time and was finally decided in a dramatic penalty shootout that tested two of the Extraliga's top goalies, Igor Murin and Marek Pintz, to their limits. On Zlín's home ice, Vítkovice snatched victory from the East Moravians when Zbigniew Irgl sent the puck flying between the goalie Murin's legs. And we just got time for one more story. Cross-country skiing now, and Katerina Neumanova ended the best season of her career in style, winning the silver in the 15-kilometre skiathlon in Falun in Sweden, 12.3 seconds behind Norway's Marit Bjørgen. This meant that Neumanova managed to repeat her huge success of 2002, ending the season in second place in the World Cup standings. Neumanova described her silver in Oslo last week as the best 30k of her life, and at 32 is in top form.
Thanks, David. We move now to the first in our special series on Czechs in Canada with Radio Prague's Jan Wellinger.
In today's special, my guest is Joe Schlesinger, one of Canada's most respected journalists, who for years was the CBC's, that is, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation's, top foreign correspondent. 15 years ago, in 1989, during the fall of communism, Joe Schlesinger's news reports carried special resonance precisely because they marked a return to his homeland, Czechoslovakia. As a boy, Joe had been sent out of the country to escape the Nazis and the Holocaust. When he returned after the war, he learned his parents had not survived. And the future in the country once again looked dim as Czechoslovakia's communists assumed power. Working then for the AP, the Associated Press, Schlesinger saw the first arrests and decided it was only a matter of time before he'd have to get out.
I spent 2 years in hospitals between 46 and 48, and by the time I came out of hospital, the communists had taken over. I was looking around for a job, and the only qualification I had is that I spoke English. So I got a job with the AP, and they started arresting people in the bureau. So that was the immediate impulse to leave. Whether I would have left without it, I don't know. I mean, there were a lot of people who had thought over the idea at the time, but didn't do it because it was dangerous. The other thing is that I didn't have any family left, so there was nothing really to hold me in that sense. My network of friends had also disappeared, so I really had nobody.
The decision to finally leave?
The first attempt didn't work. I paid a guy who knew his way through Bratislava to Petržalka on the other side of the Danube. We got across there, and we were just about to cross over when we ran, we could see a patrol with a dog coming, so we hid, and the dog didn't smell us. So we went back to town and couldn't cross that day. But I tried again in February 1950, and again we paid off somebody who knew the area, and there was a kind of a forbidden zone around the border. But somehow we had got a pass to go through to that zone, to go to České Velenice. And on the other side of the river, it's Gmünd in Austria. And I went with a girlfriend, and walked along the river. This was still early on, so it wasn't as it was later on, but there were machine gun towers that we could see, and the river was frozen, and at some point we just sort of ran across the river, dropped into a ditch on the other side, and we hadn't been seen by anybody in the tower. Because even if they hadn't gunned us down, this was the Russian zone, the Soviet zone of Austria, so they could have reported to the Russians, who would have picked us up. So that was it.
You could have stayed in Western Europe. How did the decision to come to Canada come about?
Oh, my brother was already in Canada. My brother had left in early 48, couple of months after the communists took over, he left under some sort of scheme for Jewish war orphans coming to Canada, so my brother could get me a visa to Canada. Otherwise, you know, there was a possibility of going to Australia. I mean, there were possibilities. But if you were European, Australia seemed very far, far away.
And did you have any kind of preconception of what life in Canada might be like?
I don't know, but I had some surprises, you know. When I got to Vancouver, I remember what is now the Granville Street Bridge, which is a soaring concrete kind of thing that soars over False Creek. And it was a wooden bridge, low-level bridge. And the streetcars went over this, and every time some junk barge went through into this False Creek, the bridge would open and everything would stop. And I thought, my God, you know, I mean, the streetcars, too, were kind of wooden-sided. And, you know, in Prague, they were much more modern. To say nothing, I'd been in London, Paris, and God knows where else, and Vienna. And it just seemed that the New World was very old-fashioned.
You pursued studies in economics, but you had already been bitten by the journalist bug with your experience at the Associated Press, and you began writing for the university paper. What were some of the more important lessons that you learned in this period?
First of all, I wasn't bitten by the journalistic bug. That sort of came by accident. You know, I just wandered into the student newspaper, and before I knew it, I was the editor of it, so that sort of did that, I suppose. It was a student newspaper, so the tone was much lighter, and the Frosh Queen Festival at homecoming was important, and football games, and God knows what other entertainments, and it was kind of fun. It wasn't all about disasters and about coups and invasions and war.
Gradually you began considering a serious career in journalism. What was kind of the turning point?
Oh, well, the UBC was a student newspaper, but while I was doing that, I also got a night job at the Vancouver Sun on the police beat. So I covered all sorts of night police stuff, robberies and accidents and stuff like that. And I quickly realized that Vancouver, in the newspaper business that I was in, it was just too parochial. It was the end of the line in the news business. So I struck out for Toronto and got a job at the CBC for a while, then at the Maclean Hunter, then the Toronto Star. And journalists in those days in Canada went overseas for a couple of years. You went to London and you worked for either Reuters or UPI or something other. And then you came back. And so I went to London and got a job. Then I was offered a job at the Herald Tribune in Paris. Met my wife there. We got married. Our kids were born there. And I probably would have stayed there if it hadn't for the fact that Paris, while it was great, it's great for lovers, it's not so great for raising little kids. I moved back to Canada with my family, got a job at the CBC as foreign editor. Then within a few months, they came back to me and offered me the job of executive producer of The National, which was their main news program. So, and I became the head of CBC TV News, then decided news management was not what I wanted to do. And went abroad, went to Hong Kong, then to Paris, then to Washington, then to Berlin, you know.
How did you find, for instance, the transition from working in print to working in broadcasting?
I managed it. There's a great difference, but I started in television at the production end as an editor, not as a correspondent, not as a reporter. So I saw what reporters were doing. And I think I learned that way. So when I went out into the field, I guess I just took to it.
When you're covering a conflict, like in Vietnam, is there anything, any kind of school that can prepare you for that kind of reporting? I expect it's an experience like no other.
Yes, it is, but there are two things. One, I used to tell myself, you survived Hitler, you survived Stalin. The rest is sort of child's play after that. That was one thing. The other thing, I also realized when I was boss of CBC TV News, I had a young reporter named Bobby Scafino, and he wanted to go to Vietnam, and I said to him, Bobby, you're 29 years old. You have a wife and two kids, another one on the way. There's no way I'm going to send you to Vietnam to a war zone. So we sent him on some assignment to northern Ontario and in a small plane. And on the way back, they crashed and it killed him. And I decided, well, if you're going to die, you're going to die. And so off I went to Vietnam, even though I was married and I had two kids. You know, it just seemed to be you do what you have to do. And you follow your gut instincts.
I imagine as well that many of the stories that you covered and many of the people that you met, whether it was in Vietnam or in El Salvador or other places, that those stories have stayed with you.
Oh, yes, definitely. You can go to whatever part of the world you want, whatever conflict you want, and you will see things that always seem to say the same, that they're losers and winners, and that the losers can suffer for no reason at all, and that the winners, well, there's a certain amount of common elements to all of them. The way they handle it, the way they handle themselves, the way they impose themselves, whether they're left or right.
What about moments of great historic importance, Gorbachev's reforms, perestroika, and glasnost?
You know, I was there when Gorbachev came to Washington. I was with Reagan in Moscow, and I was there in 1987 when Reagan was in Berlin and made a speech about tear down that wall, Mr. Gorbachev. And I remember thinking at the time, that's not likely to happen very soon. Of course it did.
I was one of those many Canadians of Czech descent who watched you reporting from Prague on those heady days of the Velvet Revolution. What was it like for you to be there at that time, to experience something that you never thought would happen?
I think it was one of the great moments of my life. I had to leave the country twice. And in all that time, between the time I left in 39 and the time I came back in 89, Czechoslovakia had a rough, rough time. First the Nazis, then the communists. Finally, I was able to return and watch that era, that tyranny, the last of it vanish. It was a kind of a personal vindication.
That was Joe Schlesinger speaking to Radio Prague's Jan Wellinger. I'm afraid that's all we have time for today. From me, Kate Barrett, and all of us here at Radio Prague, thanks for listening.